We are working our way through Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, commonly known as the Sermon on the Mount. It's early in the second year of Jesus' earthly ministry, and he's getting pretty well known after this first year, you know, of doing miracles and speaking such wisdom that people just can't believe it. And on this particular day, he has just spent the night in prayer, selected the 12 that will be his apostles, and he takes the 12 and most likely a few others, and they kind of go up the hill a little bit up in the northern part of Galilee to a secluded place to get away from the crowd. And Jesus sits down and teaches them. Now, what he's doing here is he's planting the seed. He's establishing the foundation for what these people will then go on to teach and share with others. And really, I don't know where you heard the gospel. Somebody shared it with you. You read it in a book. You saw it on TV. You heard it on the radio, whatever. You can trace it back to this day when Jesus shared these things with his closest followers, and then as the years went by, you know, and the Apostle Paul later came, and eventually, somehow, some way, we all heard the gospel, and we were convicted by the Spirit, and we surrendered our sin to what Jesus did on the cross, and we launched into what John 3 calls a born-again life. Now, as Jesus began to teach here, it's as if he sat the people down and said, "Look, here's what I want you to know." There's a lot of things he could have talked about, but he said, "This is what I want you to know. On that day, in these circumstances, in this context, these are the things that he wanted to share with those closest followers." And we've already worked our way through chapter 5, and now we come to chapter 6. Depends on how you count. This is either the third or fourth, you know, general segment, chunk of teaching, ideas that he covers. Realize, if you got your Bible open, look back in chapter 5, verse 16, to get going here. This is when Jesus said, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." You know, you don't put a light under a basket. Let your light shine before men so that your Father in heaven is glorified. Now, in chapter 6, verse 1, he says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father, who sees in secret, will himself reward you openly." Well, which is it? Let your light shine, or don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing? Well, as with most godly principles, the difference has to do with the motives behind the actions. In chapter 5, verse 16, he clearly says the motive is to bring glory to God. Let your light so shine so that God is glorified. In chapter 6 here, the motive is to bring glory to yourself. At the end of chapter 2, or verse 2, excuse me, that they may have glory from men. That's the difference. See, if you do the right thing, but with wrong motives, you short-circuit any potential gain or blessing. You have to do the right thing, the right way, for the right reason. And when that's the case, God is glorified. And he says, "Let your light shine." Now, verse 1 really sets the tone for everything that follows all the way through verse 18. And we're going to divide this larger passage into at least two, possibly 3 weeks, 3 studies, because today he introduces the idea and talks about one specific thing. We'll get to it in a minute. Then he talks about prayer, applying the same principle to prayer, and then he applies the same principle again to fasting. And the principle, simply put, is that devotion does not put itself on display. So, verse 1 sets the tone. Again, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men. Take heed, he says. Listen up. You know, he's been talking for a while, chapter 5, however long it took him to say what he said in chapter 5. And now he comes to this important kind of pivot point in the message. And he says, listen up. This is really important. The NIV says, be careful. The New American Standard says, beware. And the New Living Translation says, take care. Now, the reason I make such a big deal out of this is because this word is a present active imperative, and what all that means is be always aware. That's where beware comes in. It's always be aware. You know, always remember and never forget. Be constantly mindful. In other words, Jesus is saying, hey, this is important. What he's about to teach us in this verse, verses 2 through 18, this is important, so pay attention, take heed. He says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men. Now, I'm reading, as always, from the New King James, and this is a case where the evidence, I wanted to say the manuscript evidence, I'm not sure that's the right term, but the evidence from the original documents really lends itself more strongly to a slightly different understanding. There are two words, and one is transliterated in the New King James, or the Old King James, excuse me, the Authorized Version, alms, A-L-M-S, and usually we associate that with a financial giving. You know, someone's on the corner and they need 50 cents, and so you give them a couple quarters, and that's giving alms. Then there's this other word, which is usually translated righteousness. Now, in the language of the day, those words were interchangeable in common speech one way. See, if you meant alms, if you meant giving, then you could also use the word righteousness. You know, your right thing, your good deed, your giving deed, kind of the same thing. But the words don't translate the other way. When the word alms or giving doesn't necessarily translate or equate with righteousness. Now, I say all that, it's kind of technical stuff, but a better translation for this, a more literal or more accurate, I should say, translation would be, do not do your righteous living before men to be seen by men. Now, righteous living, you know, the NLT, New Living Translation just says good deeds. The New International Version comes the closest, in my opinion, when it says, don't do your acts of righteousness. Now, I know for the unchurched or those who aren't familiar with the word, you hear the word righteousness and you assume what it means. But most of the time, it's kind of like the word perfect in the Bible. We assume we know what that means, but it doesn't mean what you usually assume it means. Righteousness does not here refer to some sort of sinless perfection, some sort of strong-willed, bite the bullet, do the right thing, and never do the wrong thing. What he's talking about here is the same thing he talked about up in verse 6 of chapter 5 when he said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And I translated it then, paraphrased it, I should say, as right living, right things, but with this caveat, it's right according to God's definition of what's right. Now again, that doesn't mean legalistically toe the line, follow the rules. It's right living. When God says thou shalt not murder, that's not a bad idea. You know? Ever. Don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat, don't covet, and all the way down the list. You know, there's a lot of things, and there's a lot of positives too. You know, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. You know, have no other gods before me. And it's not one of the Ten Commandments, but, you know, the Shema in Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, your God is one. There shall be, you know, have no other gods before him. And when they asked Jesus, what are the most important commandments? He also quoted Deuteronomy when he said, love your neighbor as yourself. So this idea of righteousness, take heed that you don't do your right living, your response to grace living, your born again living. You know, you have this personal encounter with God, and as Dr. Blackaby said in that little video, you know, you don't meet God and not have it make a difference in your life. If you think you met God, but your life is no different, then maybe you didn't meet God. I mean, let's think about that a little, you know, more carefully. This whole idea of the right living that he talks about here is just that response to God's grace. I am a wretch. I am a sinner. And even if I never sinned again from this moment on, I've already sinned so much that I'm completely, utterly disqualified to ever expect, let alone deserve, any good thing that might come from God. And even if I had never sinned, which is impossible, but if I had never sinned from birth, you know, if I had never been a cranky baby, if I had never been a two-year-old that demanded my own way, I want it now, I dropped my bink and I can't find it and I'm going to throw a fit until somebody finds it for me. If that rebellious nature was never expressed, if I never told a lie, if I never stole a piece of candy, I still am disqualified from fellowship with God because of the part of my nature that leads me to tell a lie or steal candy or be selfish or whatever. I've said it 100 times. I'm not a sinner because I sin. I sin because I'm a sinner. I lie because I'm a liar. I steal because I'm a thief. And even before I steal my first piece of candy, that thief lives in my heart. And that alone disqualifies me from fellowship with God. But then one way or another, somebody shows me a tract or I catch a goofy guy with a cigar on TV, which is my story, in the middle of the night. One way or another, God's truth kind of breaks through this stubborn, prideful, you know, godless attitude. And I begin to think, wow, maybe there is a God. And maybe he does have something to offer me. And maybe the gospel's true when it says that he loves and accepts me just the way I am before I change anything about my habits or my personality or my lifestyle. And then you get, you know, Jesus explained it pretty well in chapter 5, you know, when I realize that I'm poor in spirit, I am completely bankrupt when it comes to spiritual currency. And my only hope is to rely on the mercy, the generosity of God. I mourn the consequences of sin in my life, what it's done to me, what it's done to people around me, what the principle of sin has done to the planet we live on and all creation. That's when I begin to, you know, hunger and thirst for righteousness, not to be a goody two-shoes, holier than thou, but I hunger and thirst for the right way of living, the way that God invented and, you know, designed and created me to live, a life in connection with him and a life that doesn't lie for its own, you know, selfish sake and all those other things that he went through in verses 2 through 12 in chapter 5. So now he puts all that together. Because remember, for us, it's been a few weeks. For Jesus, it's been maybe 5 minutes since he spoke the words in the previous chapter. Take heed that you don't live the God kind of life before men to be seen by them. See, and he's talking here again about motives. Don't live a good life, a godly life, a devoted life, a worshipful life, a prayerful life. We're going to look at next week a fasting, you know, disciplined kind of life. Don't bother living that kind of life if you're only doing it to be seen by people, to impress them, that they might be impressed with you by your spirituality. Oh, he's a holy man, you know. He's got calluses on his knees. Well, if he's a holy man, he probably won't let you see his knees. Because he doesn't want you to say he's a holy man. He's talking here about motives. Otherwise, you know, if you live your God-centered life to be seen by other people, then you have no reward from your Father in heaven. And I guess the question is, what kind of reward are you looking for? Are you looking to be seen by everybody else as whatever your idea of a, quote, good Christian is? There's no such thing as a good Christian. We're just sinners who've been forgiven. And that's past and present. And we'll continue to sin in some way, even if it's just in our thoughts, until the Lord comes and we're with him and free from this presence of sin, this flesh nature where the sin lives. So what kind of reward are we looking for? Do we want to impress people? Do we want them to sort of bow down when we walk by? Oh, you know, I know pastors like that. I met a guy in Hawaii, on Kauai, Pastor Bob. I was going to speak at his church, and I had just met him, and we were in the back room, and we were praying together for the service, and it was, you know, a very neat time to go together before the Lord. And then we were done, amen, and one of his assistants came in the little room where we were praying, and he put his hand on Bob's shoulder. I can't do this or I'll hurt myself. He put his hand on Bob's shoulder, and Bob went, "Hey, I told you not to touch me." Well, he was joking. But I didn't know that. I went, "Geez, this guy is off the wall. What's going on here?" Well, of course, it was, you know, that's a ridiculous thing to do, and we all got a good laugh out of it. But there are some people who, you know, in essence, if not literally, that's kind of how they feel about themselves, whether they're officially, you know, in the ministry or just, or not. We're all in ministry, you know, let's settle that right now. But, you know, this idea of being seen, being highly esteemed, you know, in Jesus' day, that was the whole trip of the religious people, the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees. They dressed a certain way. They walked a certain way. They talked a certain way. They went certain places and didn't go certain places. And they expected, as they walked down the street to buy some fish at the fish market, for people to go, "Oh, Rabbi, you know, blessed art thou," kind of a thing. And Jesus says, look, if that's how you're living your life, if that's why you're living your God-centered life, then that sort of bow down and pat on the back appreciation, that's all you're ever going to get out of it. So what's the goal here? What are we looking for? Turn to Luke chapter 18, and we're going to see an example of the very thing that Jesus is talking about. Luke chapter 18, about verse 9. Because we see here two very different kinds of people. They both would say they love God. They both would, you know, be seen as on fire, you know, religious, believing people, serving their God the best they know how. If you asked them, you know, "Are you a believer?" They'd both say, "Oh yeah, I am. No question about it." So verse 9 of Luke 18, "Also he," that's Jesus, "spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others." Now catch that before we even get into the parable. They trusted in themselves that they were righteous. Their right living before God was kind of a show. It was pretend. It was religious. You know, this is a little bit off track, but I think about the most offensive thing anybody could ever say about me would be, "Oh, he's very religious." You can talk about my mother. You can talk about, you know, all kinds of nasty stuff about me, but if you call me religious, I'm offended. Because that word, because that the idea of being a religious person, that's just beside the point, I guess. I get off track. But these are the people. They're religious. It doesn't say they trusted in the Lord. They trusted in themselves that they were righteous, not they trusted in the Lord and his righteousness and the righteousness that he granted them or imputed to them or bestowed upon them, you know, the righteousness of Christ because your sin was removed on the cross. Anyway, on with the story. Two men went up to the temple to pray. You know, you go up to the temple in Jerusalem, the top of Mount Moriah, and that's where the temple is, and that's where you go three times a day to pray according to a regular schedule. Two men went up. One was a Pharisee, you know, a very religious man, a priest, and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. Underline that, with himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Are you kind of getting a hint of where this guy's head and where his heart is? He stood to be seen. He didn't cower down in the corner humbly and bow his head and fold his hands and pray to God. He stood up where everybody was sure to see him. He probably went, everybody get ready. I'm going to pray. And he prayed with himself. Man, this is, Jesus said this. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it's not a good thing. He wanted others to think he was praying to God, but he was praying with himself. He says, I fast twice a week. Well, the word scripture only requires those guys to fast once a week. But he's going to do better than that. He's going to fast twice a week. He says, I tithe from all that I possess. Well, the tithe is supposed to be on your increase. So he's actually saying here, I outdo God, by a mile. Verse 13, and the tax collector, the other guy, the loser, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but he beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. He's a tax collector. Now, the reason that's such an awful thing, you got to understand, Israel was occupied by an invading army, the Romans. It was kind of like, similar to what's going on in, or what has been going on over in the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, all that stuff. There's an occupying military force, that's in charge, sort of against the will, in some cases, of the native population. In this case, the Jews did not like this one little bit. But the Romans were tougher and had a bigger army and more guys, and they won the battle. And so now Israel is kind of under the heel of the Roman soldier. And the tax collector was a Jew, an Israelite brother, who had, in essence, joined the other side and was now collecting taxes for Rome from his Jewish brothers and sisters. And you can just go, you rat. You dirty rat, how can you work for those Romans and you take my money and give it to them, And what makes it even worse is that the whole profit margin for a tax collector was how much above and beyond what was actually owed Rome he could collect. And they left it up to him. It wasn't like, 5%, 10%. He just kind of looked at you and looked at how many donkeys you had and what kind of shape your sheep were in. And he said, I think your tax is, let's just say 80,000 drachmas. Well, the tax might be 10,000, the actual tax the Romans charged. And he kept the rest. He pocketed the rest. That's called extortion. So these guys are legal extortioners. They're traitors to their countrymen, racially or ethnically, as well as spiritually, and that's why the tax collectors were just despised. That's why they accused, he eats with tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors are in a whole other category than sinners even. These are the worst guys. So this tax collector, he comes, but look, it says he stood afar off. He didn't come into the middle of the crowd and go, everybody, He stood off, in the corner, back in the dark. He didn't even feel comfortable approaching the place of prayer. It said he wouldn't raise his eyes. He wouldn't even look up. That's a sign, really, of the mourning Jesus talked about in chapter 5, verse 4. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those whose awareness of their own sin elicits a response of grief and sadness. And the guy wouldn't even look up, and he said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Not, I'm glad I'm not like these other jerks, like the first guy. Be merciful to me, God. Not boasting like the other guy. And what does Jesus say in verse 14? I tell you, this man, that is the tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. That's the principle he's getting at here in 6:1. Those who would do their righteous deeds to be seen by men. Well, then a pat on the back and a, hey, buddy, aren't you cool? That's about all you can expect. Because the Lord doesn't have any use for that. Your heart's wrong. Your motive's wrong. See, God knows why you do what you do. Whatever you do. And it's that motive that matters the most to him. Now, verse 2 begins the application of the principle from verse 1, that is, devotion doesn't put itself on display. And he says in verse 2, therefore, because devotion doesn't put itself on display, when you do a charitable deed, now this is the word translated alms, and that's why some translators ascribed this to the previous verse, because in context, Jesus is talking about alms, but really verse 1 sets the tone for the whole passage that follows. When you do a charitable deed, you know, when you give to the poor, when you help somebody out, when you give them a jump, when you pull them out of the ditch, when you bring them a pie. Poor people don't have any pies. Got to bring them a pie. When you do that, don't sound a trumpet. You know, look at me, I'm about to do something good. Don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues. Well, the synagogues were the churches. So he's talking about the priests. Don't blow a trumpet, you know, in the synagogue and in the street, out where the regular people are, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. When you do a charitable act, did you notice that? Underline that word when, because it's not the same as if. Giving is assumed. When you do your charitable act or give your alms, you know, when you express a generous spirit that way, that God's people give is an assumption. Now, in Jesus' day, many people couldn't survive without the generosity of others. Now, I see these guys. We used to live down in Vancouver, right where Highway 500 meets up with I-5. And in our corner by the freeway ramp, there was these people who stood there with the sign that said, you know, please help, you know, need food, can't eat, and will work for food. Except I know if a buddy of mine pulled over and said, hey, jump in the car, I got a day's work for you. Well, how much will I make? Oh, I don't know, 50, maybe 75, 80 bucks, you know, for an 8-hour shift. I was some sort of like cleaning up a construction site or something. And the guy said, no, I can't afford that. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'll make like $200-$300 standing here today. Yeah. And then it turned out it was this guy and his wife and a friend of theirs or a brother-in-law or a cousin or something. There was two guys and a gal. That was their full-time occupation, working that corner. They had an apartment, you know, a condo over right across the street that they paid for with their money. None of them had a job. I mean, when you're down and out, you know, and you got your nothing left to do but, you know, rely on the generosity of others, that's one thing. I don't think it's fair to criticize somebody for being in dire straits like that. But these guys were, you know, they were, you know, they could afford smokes, which if you're starving, seems like, especially these days, you know, $5-6 a pack for cigarettes. Yeah, it's lunch. So how hungry was he? But see, in Jesus' time, there were a lot of people who really, if it weren't for the generosity of others, they would starve. They would cease to exist. And there were certain places up by the temple or down by the pool where, you know, the blind people and the lame people would get down there every day with their cup. And it was just kind of a given as you walk by. You throw a nickel here or a dime there, you know, the equivalent of. Or you give them, you know, you help them out and that's how they survive. And so when Jesus talks about giving here, he's not just talking about a handout, you know, it's like don't feed the bears kind of a thing. He's talking about, you know, a genuine need. When you do that, not if you do that, but when you do that. See, this was Social Security. This was public assistance. This was emergency aid. you know, you need some money, you go out at the right place with your cup, and people know that, man, I got, you know, we're going to help this people out. So that God's people give to support the work of the Lord and provide for those in God's family who can't provide for themselves has always been God's way. So therefore, when you do a charitable deed, don't sound a trumpet. You know, don't announce it with a da-da-da-da where everybody can hear. Where this probably came from, this isn't in the Bible, but it's in a Jewish tradition that at a certain point in time, the priests would, when they were about to sort of, you know, they would give out money to those in need, and they would step out on the sidewalk and literally blow a trumpet, and that was the call for everybody to come. We're gonna, you know, we're gonna help you out. We're gonna hand out some money. Now, what is in the Bible is probably the source for that, whether that's a myth or whether that's a fact, comes from the idea that in the temple treasury area, there were 14 hammered metal funnels, and they called them trumpets because it looks like the end of a trumpet where it flares out. Now, I didn't bring my coins today, but you know, when the rich guy goes up, he takes his money bag and slowly pours those coins onto that metal trumpet, you know, flared metal thing. It makes quite a racket. And the louder and longer that goes on, then the more attention you're going to get. And people, oh, isn't he generous? Isn't he wealthy? Oh, look what they're giving. And then, you know, somebody who's not as well-to-do, you know, not so much. But in cases like that, this rich guy, you know, he pours out a bag of money, and it takes, like, it's like waiting for the light to change. You know, when's this ever going to get? Boy, that's a big bag of money. Of course, he's letting it trickle out as slow as he can, make as much noise. Well, everybody looks and goes, ooh, how generous, oh, how rich. Well, that's all the reward he's going to get. Lord is not impressed. He doesn't consider that generous. He doesn't consider that sacrificial. He considers that self-serving and egotistical because, again, who gets the glory? Not the Lord. He gets the glory. The guy gets the glory, and that is his reward. In Luke chapter 2, go ahead and turn up there, or 21, I mean, Luke 21, is the story about, and you probably know this story, the widow's mite. In, I suppose we should read it. I could just tell it, but Luke 21, right at the top of the chapter, verse 1, he looked up, and just like I was describing, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. You know, clang, 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 as the coins pour into the thing. And then he also saw a certain poor widow putting in two mites. Now, a mite is not an insect. A mite is a little tiny coin, and somebody told me once it was worth about a tenth of a penny, but then the value of a penny changes all the time, so I don't know what it's really worth. Much less, I guess, these days, a hundredth of a penny, a twentieth of a penny. And she had two of them. So after this big, loud, clanging, you know, cacophony of coins hitting the trumpet, she went up and it was like, tink, tink. Not very impressive. Not an attention getter. You know, not a signal of incredible wealth or generosity. So he said, Jesus said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all. What? For all of them out of their abundance have put in offerings for the Lord. But she, out of her poverty, put in all the livelihood that she had. See, if these givers are given out of their abundance, if they're given to the point where it doesn't really matter, you know, I can give these coins to the Lord. I can go down to Chuck E. Cheese and play pinball. Doesn't matter to me. Might as well give it to the Lord. Again, not impressive. But the widow, you know, first of all, she's a widow means she's got no man to take care of her. She's on her own in the world. And those two mites, those two tenths of a penny or so, you know, all she's got to live on, that out of her devotion and her affection and her appreciation for who God is and all that he does, she gives him all that she's got. And in Jesus' economy, she gave more than the rich guy. Don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do. There's that word. You know, if there's one thing in the New Testament, if there's one thing that Jesus hates, it's hypocrisy, which is a sort of a spin on pride. That word hypocrite, it comes from the word for wearing a mask, pretending to be one thing while you're really another. I don't know if you've ever been involved in the theater club at school or something like that, and they have the happy face and the sad face, the two masks. You know, that's the symbol of, that's what that means, hypocrisy. Wearing one mask, you know, pretending to be one thing when in reality you're really something else altogether. And that's who these people he's talking about were or are. They're pretending to give to God. They're pretending to bless the Lord or want to bless the Lord, but really they just want the blessing of being seen. And he says, if that's all you want, then that's all you'll get. If the reward sought is a claim and admiration, then okay, you can have that, but that's all. Now, verse 2 here, where verse 2 is a warning, verse 3, or actually verses 3 and 4, tell us the way that giving ought to work in the life of a believer. But, he says, Bible students, contrast, not this, but that. You know, when the hypocrites give, this is how it is, but when you believers, you disciples, you born-again children of God, when you do a charitable deed, when you give to the poor, when you're generous, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Now, that seems kind of weird, doesn't it? Obviously, that's code or parabolic at best. Is not, you know, he's telling us something, but he's using figurative language. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is. Sometimes my left hand doesn't know what my right hand is doing. That's when you end up with one green sock and one black sock. He's not talking here about being sneaky. It doesn't say hide, you know, the left hand from the right hand. It's not some sort of covert, you know, secret in that sense, because really there's a danger there of pride too. Oh, I can't let anybody know. And see, again, you're going to do a good thing, but you're doing it the wrong way for the wrong reason. And that's what the Lord is concerned about here. If you're going to do the right thing, do it the right way for the right reason, because that blesses the Lord and then you get the reward. More about the reward part in a minute. Don't let the right hand know what the left hand. In other words, without guile, without scheming about it. Duplicity is another word, kind of means the same thing as hypocrisy. Don't be two-faced about it, is what he's saying. I had a good friend years ago. I haven't seen him for a while now, but he was very wealthy, and he was very generous. And, you know, if he took you out to dinner, he always paid the check. If he invited you to go, you know, he took us up to this resort up in Hoods Canal once, and he not only invited us, but he paid for the motel rooms and the meals. I mean, we were his guest. He was very wealthy. He was very generous, and it was great to be his friend because he enjoyed, you know, treating the rest of us poor, you know, losers. And I didn't find out for years later, though, that as it turned out, he was always keeping score. And what seemed like generosity, really, in his head, you owed him something, sometime. Not, you know, not the rightful kind of thing. Well, gosh, he's been such a good friend to me. I'm going to be a good friend to him. I'm going to be generous and helpful and supportive and caring and loving and all those good things. No, it was come down to the point where, you remember that time we took you up to Rosanna? You know, you and your wife were up there for 3 days and the meals and all that stuff, and we actually took a float plane from the resort into Seattle to the recording studio. Not only did I treat you, but I paid you, you know, for working for me. He goes, and so because of all that, I'm here to collect, in so many words. I'm here to collect, and you owe me. Well, that just knocks the wind right out of all the good feelings about how generous and wonderful and giving he was, you know. And this idea of having, you know, duplicity and scheming all the time you're giving, kind of keeping score and keeping count about, well, then they owe me, and so, you know, I'm gonna call in that debt someday. How many of you have heard of the Samaritan's Purse organization. Probably, okay, a lot of you. Most people have, especially in church circles. Samaritan's Purse. Now, without raising your hand, I just want to ask a rhetorical question. Do you know who's behind Samaritan's Purse? Okay, some of you do. Some of you might not. Just so you'll know, it's turns out to be Franklin Graham, son of Billy Graham. But he didn't call it Franklin Graham Presents Samaritan's Purse or Franklin Graham International. Now, I got to be careful here because, you know, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association is a wonderful organization, and I would never accuse Dr. Graham of being, you know, self-serving or selfish, but I think that Franklin kind of puts this principle on display a little better. As a matter of fact, I'm always cautious of any ministry where they associate an individual's name. That's why you don't see Tootle Christian Fellowship, Pastor Ron Stevens. No. No. Maybe, you know, I like it on our bulletin, it used to say Senior Pastor Jesus. I like that. I don't mind that. But I'm always just a little uncomfortable when somebody comes in with this idea and it's got their name at the top, you know? That's what he's talking about here, the way it ought to work. Don't let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. Don't come up with a scheme to promote yourself. Just do it. You know, if you're going to give to God or give because of God, then just do that. And don't try to get some other sort of personal benefit out of it. So that, the result of this, when you do a charitable deed, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your charitable deed may be in secret, that is unpublicized, you know, no attention drawn to it, like that guy in the temple making everybody look at him. And then your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. Secret, a better word might be privately. Because again, he's not encouraging us to be sneaky and, you know, scheming about this, but just do it privately. Not a display of your devotion meant for the public to see so that they think highly of you, so that they think of you at all. And you'll be at the end, this is the capper here, your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. Get the contrast there. If you do these things privately, when you do your charitable acts, not if, and you do them privately without drawing attention to yourself, then your Heavenly Father who sees what's done in private will reward you openly. And I think that may apply more so to the eternal kingdom than it does right here, right now. I don't think it's the case where if I give $1 million and don't put my name on it, then God's going to make me, you know, a rock star. When you give gladly, when you give with pure motives to bless God, not bring attention to how spiritual you are, then he says God will reward you openly. In the eighth grade, I decided to go out for the track team. I don't know why. You know, I can't, even at the peak of my physical, you know, youthful fitness and prowess, I could never run more than maybe a quarter of a mile without having to stop. My lungs just don't. Never, even then, didn't oxygenate my body sufficient. I knew a guy named Don Coogan. He could just run forever. Okay, Don, start running. Okay. And he'd just be running, and he'd be talking to the guy next to him or the guys behind him, more like it. And he could just run and run and run and run and run, and he could go 10 miles, 20 miles. He could run for an hour in gym class. And they'd say, okay, stop. And he'd stop and go, okay, now what do you want to do? Well, you know, there's me. He'd go, you know, give me some oxygen, call 911. So I decided, I get the bright idea, I'm going to go out for the track team. I couldn't make the basketball team or the football team. They didn't have a baseball team, but I want to do something. So I go out for the track team. And, of course, I know I can't run, although they make you run and track. So I was going to do the shot put and the javelin and the discus. You know, they call those the big man events. Well, I was the biggest man they had. I was about what you see is what you get. I had more hair, but other than that, not much has changed. Well, I stunk. I'm not just not an athletic guy. I don't have zero hand-eye coordination. Now, God's gifted me with hand-ear coordination, you know. But hand-eye coordination, then you throw a ball, and I can go like this, and the ball just goes. It just, there's no connection between how do you do this or throwing or whatever. And that applies to the shot put, and they teach us how to do it. And you I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. I never could do it. But you kind of kick back, and then finally you spin around, and you go, ugh! And the thing would go like, 6 feet, and thump. Because I couldn't get the technique down. I could just spin around a couple times, and then I'd walk over with all shoulder and throw the thing, and you can't throw it like a baseball. You got to kind of push it. So it didn't go anywhere. The javelin, look out. They took the javelin away from me. I thought I was going to hurt somebody. And I may have. And it wasn't much different with the discus, because the discus, you get down and you spin around in a circle. And I'm telling you, I just about took out the crowd 3 or 4 times. So much so that the what do they call him, the referee, the judge, whatever, he'd say, look, kid, take it easy. And I never, I always came in last, and I never won anything, except one time. There were 3 shot putters on our team, and one guy wasn't there. He was sick or couldn't make it to the track meet, and the other team had 2 guys on their team, and so we all, were putting the shot. And mine went out, about 6 feet, and thump. And everybody was doing pretty good, except one of the guys on their team, he threw it way further than me, but his toe came across the line when he did it, and so he was disqualified, so I came in 3rd. I actually placed. It's the proudest moment of my life. Well, track season's over, and big deal, so what? I didn't expect to be a champion in the first place. And we're at the big school assembly, and I'm sitting out in the gym, and probably had to sit next to the teacher to keep me quiet. That's kind of my life story there. And the track coach, Mr. O'Donnell, gets up, and he says, now is the time we're going to present the letter. I went to Lewis Junior High, so it was a big L. It went on your jacket. We're going to present the letters to the members, to the guys that lettered, that earned a letter on the track team. And so they call up, Don Coogan, the guy that can just run forever. And he gets his letter, and they call up another guy and another guy and another guy. And he's calling up a whole lot of guys, and I'm going, wow, these guys, I'm over doing the, trying not to kill somebody with my shot put, and I guess these guys all did pretty good. And then he called my name. There must be some mistake. I mean, I certainly didn't. I came in 3rd once because the guy was disqualified. I would have been more help to the team if I was the towel boy or something. But he called me up and he gave me a letter. And after the assembly was over, I went to him. I said, Coach, I didn't earn a letter. I wasn't expecting a letter. Why in the world did I get a letter? And he never forget. He looked at me and he said, well, I saw you out there sweating a couple times. Oh. He saw me out there, coming in last in the 5-mile run. And I can actually walk faster than I could run, but, it was a pretty lame run. But he says, I saw you out there a couple times. I saw you working up a sweat a little bit. And here's the question. Does the Lord see you sweating, or does the Lord see you strutting? Because that's the difference he's talking about here. Those rock star Christians are going to be in shock when the Lord calls the name of a nobody who's been quietly working away in the trenches and says, well done, good and faithful servant. Your Father will reward openly those things that are done in private. Giving of your time, your talent, your treasure is just the first example of right living that doesn't draw attention to itself. That's the life that shines like a light before men and brings glory to God our Father. Jesus wants you to know that devotion does not put itself on display.